Today is Monday, May 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. As America gathers to celebrate Memorial Day, a White House official warned on ABC's This Week about COVID-19.
We've made it clear that there's asymptomatic spread, and that means that people are spreading the virus unknowingly.
Plus, the Gambia looks for key information in Myanmar's report to the International Criminal Court.
A demonstration by Myanmar on what measures it has taken to preserve evidence.
And more than 180 were arrested Sunday in Hong Kong during an anti-government protest. We'll have those stories and more next. It's Memorial Day in the United States, celebrated on the last Monday in May. The holiday honors the men and women who have died while serving in the nation's military. The coordinator of the White House Coronavirus Task Force is expressing concern at scenes of large outdoor gatherings of people this weekend. AP correspondent Ben Thomas starts us off.
We've made it clear that there's asymptomatic spread, and that means that people are spreading the virus unknowingly.
Dr. Deborah Birx tells ABC's This Week.
So you don't know who's infected, and so we really want to be clear all the time that social distancing is absolutely critical. And if you can't social distance and you're outside, you must wear a mask.
As for the possibility that a second wave of infections in the fall could prompt another round of shutdowns, Birx says the government is trying to learn how to reopen safely.
You know, we act like we've actually done this before. And besides 1918 and 1919, we've not ever closed parts of America. And even then, the whole country wasn't closed.
Ben Thomas, Washington.
Nearly 100,000 Americans have died from the coronavirus. The U.S. toll by far is the highest in the world. It includes more than 1,000 veterans who have died from COVID-19, according to the Department of Veteran Affairs. Around the world, there are nearly 5.5 million people who have contracted the novel coronavirus. Schools in Australia's most populous state have reopened on Monday after weeks of lockdown. Students in New South Wales, along with those in Queensland, have headed back to class in one of the most significant easings of coronavirus restrictions. Phil Mercer has more.
More than 1 million students are back in class Monday as state and private schools in New South Wales resume full-time learning after 2 months of lockdown. Authorities in the neighbouring Australian state of Queensland have also reopened schools. Many children in Tasmania are also returning to class. Victoria will begin a phased return to on-site schooling Tuesday. Social distancing measures are in place and parents and carers aren't allowed onto school premises. New South Wales Minister for Education Sarah Mitchell says the return to school has started well.
It's an exciting day for lots of parents and teachers and students right across New South Wales as we see our children return to the classroom. Again, we're so grateful to our school communities for all the preparation work that they've done to have our students back, the additional cleaning and the hygiene supplies. And by all accounts this morning, things are going very well. I think there's a lot of excitement in classrooms. It's exciting to have them back in the classroom, and we're looking forward to being back into some kind of normal when it comes to education in New South Wales.
Schools have been one of the most controversial parts of Australia's response to the pandemic. The federal government has always insisted all pupils should be in schools, while state leaders have insisted it was safer for them to be at home. Reopening schools is a significant step in Australia's winding back of COVID-19 controls. Further relaxations will come into effect at the start of June, with many cafes, bars and restaurants allowed to reopen, with strict limits on the number of patrons. However, many state borders remain closed, and Australia continues to ban all foreign nationals from entering the country. Australia has had more than 7,100 confirmed coronavirus cases. 102 people have died with the virus. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Syrian refugees in Turkey are reeling from the coronavirus pandemic lockdown that has put most of them out of work. These families say in Syria they hid in their homes, fearing bombs or bullets outside. Now they're locked down, fearing the virus, homelessness, and hunger. VOA's Heather Murdoch has that story.
8 Syrian refugees have been living in a 2-room apartment, and a 3-year-old girl, Zainab, is crying out for food. The adults plucked grape leaves from a tree to make an evening meal. But it is already afternoon, and Zainab's mother says her daughter and the other children haven't eaten all day. The rent here is cheap for Istanbul, only $30 a month. But for this family, it is still too much. Ismahan, the crying child's mother, says they haven't paid the rent in 2 months, and the landlord is threatening to kick them out. Her family normally sells tissues to drivers at traffic lights. But since the pandemic began, this kind of work is not allowed. Like most Syrian refugees in Turkey, they are doing informal work and now have no income. A patchwork of aid organizations provides some money, food, and supplies, but it's never enough. Parents say they fear their children will starve if the pandemic continues. Marwa, a mother of five, says in Syria they were locked down by the war, afraid of being killed by airstrikes if they went out. Now they are locked down by the COVID-19 pandemic, afraid of getting sick if they go out, and of starving if they do not. Turkey hosts over 3.5 million Syrian refugees, more than any other country. Public resentment towards refugees runs deep, and the government has encouraged them to leave. Refugees say as Turkey grows poorer because of the pandemic, locals become more and more hostile. This is Mohammed, Marwa's husband. In Syria, he was an opposition fighter. After fleeing to Turkey, he fixed motorcycles and painted walls as a day laborer before the pandemic put him out of work. Mohammed says he now stays up at night, fearing his children will soon be on the streets. Even after war and displacement, he adds, the hardest thing he's ever had to do is to say no when his hungry children ask for food. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Istanbul.
Myanmar submitted its first report to the International Court of Justice over the weekend. That was done in compliance with a court order earlier this year regarding accusations that Myanmar's army committed genocide against the country's Muslim Rohingya minority in 2017. Myanmar's government has denied those allegations. VOA's Carol Gunsberg spoke via Skype with the Gambia's Attorney General and Justice Minister, Aboubakar Tambadou, about the case.
I can indeed confirm that the court has shared with the Gambia Myanmar's report, which was actually submitted to the court on Friday the 22nd. We are still reviewing the report in order to assess what Myanmar has done in terms of complying with the court's orders. But we are looking for three key things. The first we are looking for is a demonstration by Myanmar in the report of action it has taken to prevent the commission of genocide. That is the first thing that we are looking for. The second one we are looking for is Myanmar's demonstration to the court that it has refrained from committing genocide. And the third thing that we are looking for in the report is a demonstration by Myanmar on what measures it has taken to preserve evidence as the court has ordered. So these are the three important things that we are looking for in particular in the report. But we also have to recognize that this is a welcome development. This is a positive development. The fact that Myanmar continues to engage with the court on this matter and that it has complied with the court's order on provisional measures, which requested Myanmar to submit this report 4 months from the date of the provisional measures order. And Myanmar has so complied. It goes to demonstrate, as far as I'm concerned, that Myanmar, consistent with its attitude in this case, is acting as a responsible member of the international community and by showing respect to the International Court of Justice, which all states around the world must do at all times. But this is a welcome development.
Is the Gambia legal team also monitoring the ground situation and collecting evidence to compare with the Myanmar report?
Well, the Gambia's team has not just been monitoring, but through information collection on the ground in Myanmar, but we are doing so through a variety of sources as well. So, yes, we have been keeping our ears and our eyes open, and hopefully we will have a basis to compare the report that Myanmar has just submitted to the court. We will see what that report contains and whether the measures that Myanmar may claim to have taken in the report are factual on.
How does the fact that Rohingyas are still fleeing Myanmar reflect on the ICJ case?
We will have to see what Myanmar has indicated in its report in terms of the measures it has taken to refrain from committing genocide or from taking positive acts to stop the commission of genocide, and juxtapose that with the fact that the refugees are still living Rakhine State. We would be interested to know what Myanmar has as explanation for this recent exodus of refugees from Rakhine State. But we will have to see what is in the report first before we can make any further assessments about that.
Aboubakar Tambadou is the Attorney General and Minister of Justice for the Republic of the Gambia. He was speaking to my colleague Carol Gunsberg from his residence in Banjul. And coming up later in the program,
Benjamin Netanyahu had already made history as the longest-serving prime minister in Israel's history. Sunday, he did it again.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
A team of scientists from the U.S., Australia, and New Zealand say they have discovered remnants of the biggest explosion in the universe since the Big Bang nearly 14 billion years ago. Using data from space and ground-based observatories, the researchers say the massive explosion was found in the Ophiuchus Galaxy Supercluster, located about 390 million light-years from Earth. One of the scientists says the explosion happened very slowly and took place over hundreds of millions of years. The researchers say there is a supermassive black hole in one of the supercluster's galaxies and that they think it was what set off the record-setting explosion. The lead author of a study detailing the discovery says that you could fit 15 Milky Way galaxies in a row inside the crater the explosion created in the galaxy cluster's field of hot gas. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Police say they have arrested more than 180 people Sunday when authorities fired tear gas and used a water cannon to disperse anti-government protesters as unrest returned to Hong Kong after months of relative calm. The demonstration comes amid concerns over the fate of One Country, Two Systems, a formula that has governed Hong Kong since the former British colony's return to Chinese rule in 1997. The arrangement guarantees the city broad freedoms not seen on the mainland, including a free press and independent judiciary. Francis Lewin is the chief executive officer of GEO Securities. He spoke to Reuters News.
According to overseas observers, if China passes the National Security Act, it will mean the death of the One Country, Two System, the end of a high degree of autonomy, and Hong Kong will become just another Chinese city. But the fact is, Hong Kong is already another Chinese city, except with free flow of capital and limited free speech. I don't think that will change that much. So I think despite foreign sanctions and rhetorics, I think Hong Kong will survive this downturn with, of course, some pains.
Journalist Ria Mogul is in Hong Kong, and she was out observing the protest this weekend. I spoke to her via WhatsApp. Ria, can you kind of explain why some protesters are saying that this is the de facto end of One Country, Two Systems, and this is why they're protesting in the way that they are? And then also expand upon why the government feels that this is the appropriate call of action, even though governments around the world, including the United States, are saying that Beijing should not encroach on the freedoms of Hong Kongers.
Right. So I think one of the biggest things is In 2003, 500,000 people took to the streets to oppose Article 23, which, if passed at the time, would have allowed Hong Kong to enact these laws, which would, curb sedition, secession, and subversion on its own. And after 500,000 people marched, the law was subsequently shelved. Now, this law that was announced on Thursday would actually bypass the city's legislature completely. And that has angered a lot of activists, a lot of Hong Kong people. They see it as a complete erosion of their rights. And that's one of the biggest reasons, actually, that they see one country, two systems being taken away. And the reason Beijing is coming down so hard on Hong Kong is, of course, last year's anti-government movement lasted for more than 7 months, only coming to a halt because of the spread of the coronavirus. And, week after week, we saw hundreds of thousands of protesters take to the streets, vandalize property, block roads. There were multiple skirmishes between police, between protesters, countless rounds of tear gas fired. And this would happen week after week. It was a recurring event. So, there's just a lot of anger on the pro-democracy side, and there's coming down even harder from Beijing because of this.
Ria, can you kind of provide some examples of some of the concerns, some of the fears that those in Hong Kong have should one country, two systems go away?
It could be that in a few weeks' time, them chanting these slogans of freedom and singing their protest anthems could be illegal. And, what does it mean for journalists? What does it mean for the press? Is there going to be a decline in freedom for the press? And what does this mean for education? People are very concerned about what they're going to learn in schools and what their kids are going to learn in schools. People are just scared. There's a lot of that there is a lot of frustration, there's a lot of uncertainty, but we do know that it is going to stop, or it is going to curb a lot of the freedoms that people in Hong Kong currently enjoy. In fact, today's demonstrations was also called to protest against a bill that would criminalize abuse of the Chinese national anthem in Hong Kong. And this law is meant to be debated within the LegCo, within the Legislative Committee on Wednesday. And Carrie Lam, the chief executive of Hong Kong, has called it a top priority. And when passed, if passed, it could be punishable by a jail term of up to 3 years for someone if they say anything against the Chinese national anthem.
Ria Mogul is a reporter living and working in Hong Kong. China's planned national security law may prompt Taiwan to revoke the special status it extends to Hong Kong. President Tsai Ing-wen made that announcement late Sunday on her Facebook page. It is a move that could anger Beijing and make it harder for Hong Kongers to visit and invest there. President Tsai said the proposed legislation was a serious threat to Hong Kong's freedoms and judicial independence, and that Taiwan would provide the people of Hong Kong with necessary assistance. Hong Kong security and police chiefs said terrorism was growing in the city as government departments rallied on Monday behind Beijing's plans to introduce the national security laws. Protests there are expected to resume on Wednesday. China's foreign minister is dismissing claims that the country is exploiting the coronavirus outbreak to expand its footprint in the South China Sea, labeling such accusations as sheer nonsense. At the same time, Beijing says it will increase its defense spending by 6.6% in 2020, despite a huge downturn in the country's economic growth due to the coronavirus outbreak. The increase is the lowest in years, but will still continue to expand China's ability to enforce its territorial claims in the South China Sea. Tens of thousands of homes and businesses have lost power. Buildings have been battered, roofs were torn off, and trees uprooted as a vast stretch of the West Australian coast was hammered by a second day of a severe storm. No casualties have been reported by authorities, which one called a once-in-a-decade type of storm system. The lead vessel of a five-tanker flotilla carrying fuel from Iran to gasoline-thirsty Venezuela neared one of its state-run ports as President Nicolas Maduro thanked Tehran on Sunday. Reuters' Libby Hogan has more.
Fuel sent from Iran was near to arriving in crisis-hit Venezuela over the weekend. The first of five tankers neared a port close to the capital, Caracas, on Saturday. That's despite a U.S. official's warning that Washington was considering a response to the shipment. While Venezuela has one of the world's largest oil reserves, it's now in desperate need of refined fuel as it grapples with economic collapse. And on Sunday, President Nicolas Maduro thanked Tehran on state TV.
Presidente Rouhani. To all of Iran, from the heart, thank you for your solidarity, for your support, for your courage, for your decision. Yesterday, the tanker arrived in Venezuela at the end of Ramadan, the sacred month of our Muslim brothers. The ship named Fortune has arrived.
In total, Iran is providing just over 1.5 million barrels of gasoline to Venezuela. The shipments have caused a diplomatic standoff between the U.S. and Iran and Venezuela that are both under U.S. sanctions. Venezuela's opposition has also condemned the shipments as they are concerned about growing ties between Iran and socialist President Maduro, who has overseen a six-year economic crisis. A second vessel, named the Forest, also entered the Caribbean Sea on Saturday, and the last three remaining vessels were crossing the Atlantic. Venezuela's refining network has been operating this year at only about 10% of its 1.3 million barrel per day capacity. While the Iranian shipments are a lifeline for Venezuela, it's only enough fuel for just a month of consumption at current rates in the nation that was once a prominent fuel exporter.
Libby Hogan reports for Reuters News. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu went on trial Sunday on charges of fraud, corruption, and breach of trust. If convicted, Netanyahu faces years in jail. Linda Gradstein reports he maintains his innocence and accuses the justice system of trying to engineer a coup against him.
Benjamin Netanyahu had already made history as the longest-serving prime minister in Israel's history. Sunday, he did it again, becoming the first sitting prime minister to go on trial for fraud and breach of trust. He arrived at the court from a cabinet meeting of his new national unity government. Outside the prime minister's house, hundreds of Israelis demonstrated against Netanyahu, calling on him to resign. Outside the courthouse in East Jerusalem, a similar number rallied for Netanyahu. Before entering the courtroom, Netanyahu lashed out against the court and the media, insisting that he is innocent of all charges. He said the trial is an attempt at a political coup against the will of the people. He said he will continue to fight and continue to lead the state of Israel. Netanyahu entered the small courtroom that seats about 20 people with two of his lawyers and refused to sit on the defendant's bench until photographers had been removed from the courtroom. The judges then read the charges against him, including fraud and breach of trust. Netanyahu is accused of performing favors in exchange for both gifts totaling hundreds of thousands of dollars and positive press coverage. His attorney said they needed several more months to study all of the materials, a request the prosecution said was unnecessary as the indictment was filed over a year ago. The trial is expected to take at least a year. In the new government formed earlier this month, Netanyahu is supposed to serve as prime minister for a year and a half before turning the job over to his former rival and head of a centrist party, Benny Gantz. A few months later, Israeli President Reuven Rivlin is due to retire. The president is a mostly ceremonial, although prestigious, job in Israel. It also confers immunity from prosecution. Many in Israel believe that Netanyahu is already competing for this job. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
You've been listening to International Edition of The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other device to voanews.com. And if you missed today's show, don't forget you can go to our website or download it as a podcast and take it on the go. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.